Hey, I'm Frank Chalupka. I'm an economist. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the economics of sugar-sweetened beverage taxation. This is work that I'm doing with my colleagues at the University of Illinois Chicago, Lisa Powell, another economist, and Jamie Shrieky, a political scientist. Much of this work is supported by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation as well as the NHLBI. No disclosures to make at the start. Just in terms of what I'm going to touch on, I'm going to talk quickly about the economic rationale. So Kelly's talked a lot about the public health rationale for why sugar-sweetened beverage taxes would be appropriate. I'll talk a little bit about some of the market failures in the markets for sugar-sweetened beverages that would motivate an economic rationale. I'll tell you a lot about what's going on in terms of current sugar-sweetened beverage taxation, which isn't much. And then I'll talk about some of the research that we've been doing and that others have been doing, looking at the impact of these taxes and prices on sugar-sweetened beverage consumption and weight outcomes. I'll touch briefly on sugar-sweetened beverage tax structures. There's lots of different ways you could tax something, and there's strengths and weaknesses associated with that. And then I'll talk about some of the revenue-generating potential, but not spend too much on that since Kelly's talked about that. Just in terms of the economic rationale, clearly there's a public health rationale. Kelly's already talked about that. Sugar-sweetened beverages, significant contributor to caloric intake in this country, no real benefits from them. But in addition to that public health rationale, there's really some economic arguments as to why these taxes would be appropriate. So economists talk about government intervention being appropriate when there are market failures that exist. And from my perspective, there are at least a couple of market failures in the sugar-sweetened beverage markets. The first is, I think, pretty obvious. It's the idea that there are negative externalities, that there's costs associated with the consumption of these products that are not being fully borne by the consumers of the products. So we know about the consumption contributing to obesity. We understand the huge healthcare costs associated with obesity. The most recent estimates, for example, put these costs at $147 billion in 2006. That's over 9% of healthcare spending in this country in 2006. And the key thing here is that these are costs that are not being borne just by the people that are consuming them. They're costs that are being paid for through public health insurance programs. About half of those costs are being covered through Medicare and Medicaid programs. And I think the key thing is that these are costs that are really rising very rapidly. At the rate that they're going, they're going to account for 20 or 25% of healthcare costs before too long. On top of that, there are some additional costs. You can think about lost productivity costs associated with the diseases caused by obesity that are borne by employers. But the healthcare costs are pretty clearly the ones that are most important. In addition to this, I think there are information problems in the markets for sugar-sweetened beverages. Consumers really don't fully, I think, understand the costs and benefits of their consumption decisions. They may have some sense about the caloric content of the products that they're consuming, but they really don't understand very well everything that they're consuming, how this all impacts on their weights, and I think ultimately how this all impacts on their health. This is something that really ends up being distorted by the sort of marketing that's going on. The vitamin water example I thought was a great one. So people may think they're actually consuming something that's healthy, and they don't really realize what they're taking in and the consequences of that. And then I think a big problem is that these are things that people start consuming when they're young. So kids are consuming these products. They establish habits early on that are going to persist into adulthood. Again, this would be a significant market failure. And then the last one's, I think, a little bit trickier to grasp, but it's the idea that economists talk about is time-inconsistent preferences. People really make decisions that aren't consistent over time. They try to have these long-term perspectives that are good. They want to maintain a healthy weight. They want to maintain healthy diets. But in the short run, they end up consuming things that are going to satisfy their immediate desires. They may come to regret those later on. So given that, when economists talk about how to address these sorts of market failures, we really talk about what we call first-best interventions and second-best interventions. First-best interventions are the ones that are going to deal directly with the market failure at issue. The information one is a good example. Menu labeling would be a way of directly dealing with the information problems. Some of the school-based mass media education efforts, for example, that are going on around sugar-sweetened beverage consumption would be another way of dealing with this. But, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of these things cost a fair amount to do. The big mass media education campaigns are very costly. And they don't always reach the populations that have the biggest problems. So that's where the second-best interventions come in. Second-best interventions are the ones that aren't as directly targeted to the problems that we have in the markets, but they are ones that really do have significant impact. So they are interventions that address the broader market. They address people that are engaged in healthier behaviors and fully rational behaviors. But in the end, they're much more effective than some of the first best interventions. And that's where sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, I think, really come in. Just to show you what's going on with sugar sweetened beverage taxes, most states do not have any specific taxes on sugar sweetened beverages. There are a handful that have an excise tax or something that looks like an excise tax. But the way that they are taxed currently is through state sales tax systems. Almost every state has a sales tax. Almost every state exempts foods and beverages from their sales taxes. But a lot of states then go back and disfavor the sugar-sweetened beverages, disfavor other beverages, and apply at least some sales tax to those beverages. So what this graph shows you is just what the tax rates are across the board in terms of sales taxes on average across the top, and then what the taxes are in different types of beverages. Now, so you can see by looking at this, if we're looking at soda taxes, for example, the average state sales tax that applies to soda taxes is about 3.5%. Then it goes down as you move into some of the healthier options. If we look at just the states that are taxing these beverages, the tax amounts to about 5% on average on the beverages that we're most interested in. In addition to that, a lot of states will also impose higher taxes or impose taxes on vending machine sales that they may not tax when it comes to sales through stores. So what this does is it illustrates the number of states, the percentage of states, and the taxes that are being applied to different beverages. What you end up seeing is that the tax applied through vending machine sales tends to be a little bit higher than the tax that's applied to grocery store and other store sales. If you look across the country, you can see most states have this type of tax. About two-thirds of states tax sugar-sweetened beverages. You can see that there's a few states, four or five states, that tax at 7% or higher. And then about a third of the states that have no tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. And then, like I said, there are a handful of states that do have something else, another tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, on other beverages. Some of these are excise taxes that are applied at the wholesale level or at the bottler's level. Other ones call them fees, but they basically work and act like an excise tax. So there are a handful of states that are doing that. Okay, in terms of what impact this has, I always like to start out by just looking at the simple data. This, I think, highlights something that Kelly started to show as well. If you look at carbonated beverage prices, what you can see is that while those prices may have gone up a little bit over time, once you account for inflation, they've actually gone down quite sharply over the last several decades. And completely in the opposite direction, you see the rise in obesity. So this kind of thing, if I just look at the data, it suggests to me that there's probably some relationship there. So we started to pursue this and started to take the data that we're collecting on taxes and prices, link it to data on consumption patterns and weight outcomes to see what the relationships are. Kelly's already talked about the review that Tanya published earlier this year that produced, I think, the best estimate at this point about what the point elasticity is for sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. Her estimate suggests that it's about 0.78. Price elasticity is just a concept that economists use. If you raise price by 1%, what happens to consumption? What this translated into English says is if you raise prices by 10%, you're going to get an 8% reduction in beverage consumption. On the other hand, when it comes to the evidence on weight outcomes, there's been relatively little work done in this area, and the evidence, I think, at this point is at best mixed. So this is where we've been working a lot over the last couple of years. We've been trying to take the information that we have on these differences in state sales taxation of sugar-sweetened beverages and then link it to a variety of different survey data sets to talk about what the impact is then on consumption and what the impact is on weight outcomes. And a lot of the work that we're doing is focusing on young people. So some of the work looks at household level data from AC Nielsen's HomeScan data sets. But we've also been looking at the ECLSK data, the Monitoring the Future data for 8th and 10th and 12th graders, and then longitudinal data that comes from the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, 1997. So just a couple of quick highlights from this. When it comes to the Nielsen scanner data, we have one quarter of data from 2007. We have data on over 66,000 households. And what we're looking at here is going to be a measure of ounces of beverages purchased for consumption in the household. And what we see is that on average, households are purchasing 566 ounces in that one quarter. We have lots of information on the household characteristics. We're able to control for lots of other things that would drive demand for these beverages. And what we're finding is that there's a pretty clear price effect in the household's decisions to purchase soda. So what we have here is our estimates of the point estimates for the coefficients, looking at the relationship between the sales tax rate that's applied in the states and then the household's consumption of sodas. So everywhere we're finding places that apply these sales taxes, places that apply higher sales taxes have less consumption of sodas. And what we're seeing here is that the effect is even larger in households that have kids. So what we've done is, you know, it looks like there's not much of an effect. You take these estimates, you translate them out to elasticity estimates. Our elasticity estimate is minus 0.06. So if you raise the price, if you raise the tax by 10%, that tells you that you get a 0.6% reduction in consumption. Doesn't sound like much, but the bottom line is that states aren't really taxing these things very much at this point. So if we were to take the taxes that states are applying, raise those to the maximum tax that's applied in any state, the 7% rates, what we see there is that that would have some noticeable impact on consumption. That would reduce consumption by about 3.6%. But then what we wanted to do was to look at what happens if states really take this on. If you start to think about taxes equivalent to that penny an ounce that might raise prices as much as 20%, what we find is that in the households in this sample, you'd see a significant reduction in consumption. Consumption would fall by a third as a result. All right, so then we wanted to go beyond that to look at how these taxes potentially impact on weight outcomes. The first analysis was published a few months ago in Health Affairs, and this is work that used the ECLSK data, a nationally representative sample of kids that's tracked over time. We have consumption data captured in the fifth grade and BMI for these kids. And what we're going to do is look at several different outcomes. We'll look at soda consumption, purchases of soda at school, and then weight change between waves in the survey, and relate that to the state's taxes on these beverages, controlling for lots of other things associated with the kids. And what we find here is that, you know, again, there's relatively limited evidence of an effect, but we do find some signs of an impact of these taxes on consumption behavior. So what you can see here is that for the full sample, we do see some reductions in consumption, and we do see some improvements in weight outcomes as a result of the tax. But when you start to look at the most at-risk populations, we start to see more and more potential impacts. So low-income households, minority kids, kids that are already at risk for being overweight, seem to be responding more to these changes in taxes and prices than other kids. So again, we went ahead and tried to look at the same sort of thing. What potential impact would there be if you did impose a significant tax? And what we find is that if the tax was 18% in this particular analysis, that would have led to a 20% reduction in excess weight gain between the waves of the surveys. So even though the point estimates, again, are relatively small, because the taxes are so low, if you had significant taxes, you start to see significant impact on weights. Are doing work with the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, again, looking at the changes in behaviors over time and how these taxes and prices potentially impact kids' weight gain over time, and finding basically the same sorts of evidence here. We're finding out that places that have these taxes, kids are less likely to become overweight over time, and the impact is greater the higher the tax is. So increases in the tax are going to have a positive impact in terms of reducing consumption, reducing the likelihood of obesity. Again, very much related to the level of the tax, higher taxes have a greater impact, and particularly effective when it comes to low-income populations, which are at greater risk for obesity, but also much more price-sensitive. In the interest of time, I'm going to move quickly through the last few slides. In terms of the approaches that we can take to taxation, there are, you know, basically two different types of taxes that we can apply. Sales taxes are the ones that are being used so far. Excise taxes are the ones that haven't been used except for in a handful of states. If you think back to the tobacco examples that people have talked about, everybody uses excise taxes on tobacco, not sales taxes. There's a good reason for that. Excise taxes are going to have much more of an impact on price. It's going to show up in the shelf price. Consumers are going to be much more aware of it. And the key thing here is really to think about specific excise taxes, not what we call ad valorem excise taxes. So taxes that are based on sugar content or taxes that are based on volume, not taxes that are based on price. Those would lead to substitutions down to cheaper products, which might not then have any impact on anything. And this just gives you a sense of the different impact of different types of taxes on prices. What we did here was to take a 20-ounce bottle of soda, assume the cost $1 per bottle, and then looked at what would happen if we had these different types of taxes. If we taxed that based on the grams of sugar, a penny per gram, that would raise the shelf price by 55 cents, a 55% increase in price. That would have a significant impact. If we had an ad valorem tax that was 50% of retail price, it could have a similar type of impact. So it would take a significant ad valorem tax. On the other hand, the small sales taxes that we have, 6%, has almost no impact on price. So these kind of specific big excise taxes would have a big impact on price. From a public health perspective, the same reasons it worked in tobacco, it's also going to be true here. Specific excise taxes are much more favorable than ad valorem excise taxes or than sales taxes. They show up on the shelf price more apparent to consumers, much easier to administer as far as the tax authorities are concerned. They really reduce the incentives for switching down to cheaper products in response to the tax changes. As a result of that, the revenues that you get from the tax are actually going to be much more stable over time. They're not going to be subject to the industry's price manipulations. And as a result of all of this, they end up having a bigger impact on consumption, a bigger impact on weight outcomes. And they only really have one disadvantage, and that's that they need to be updated every so often to keep pace with inflation. So they need to be regularly adjusted. Otherwise, much more effective in terms of trying to promote the sort of public health impact that we're looking for. Given that I'm almost out of time, there's not much to say on the revenue side. Kelly's already talked about the revenue calculator. Clear evidence that these tax increases, given the elasticity that we know about, would generate substantial revenues. If those revenues were earmarked for obesity prevention programs, that would add to the effects of the tax in terms of curbing obesity. So we have a website as well that has lots of information on this. The study research briefs, all the tax data, things like that are all up there. Bridging the Gap research, and then if you want the full site, you can look through that to get to the soda and snack tax page. Thank you.